Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate version of the so-called Trump-Ryan tax reform bill that eliminates some of the most flagrantly egregious giveaways to the ultra-rich in the name of middle-class tax cuts. Jeff Madrick, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, a former economics columnist for the New York Times, and the author of Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World, joins us. We'll discuss the admission by the White House economics advisor Gary Cohn that, quote, the most excited group out there are big CEOs about our tax plan, which Cohn goes on to describe as trickle-down economics. And we'll look into the truth-telling by Republican Congressman Chris Collins, who said that his big donors are saying, quote, get it done or don't ever call me again, and Senator Lindsey Graham, who admitted to blackmail by donors, suggesting that a failure to pass tax reform would split the GOP and result in more well-financed far-right challenges to incumbent Republicans. Then we'll assess the impact of the explosive revelations in a Washington Post investigation of Steve Bannon's candidate for the U.S. Senate in Alabama, Judge Roy Moore, which documents the experiences of four women who dated Roy Moore when one of the women was 14 and the others 16, and Moore was in his 30s. Zach McCrary, who served as a pollster and strategist for members of Congress, mayors, state legislative caucuses, and public interest groups in Alabama, joins us to discuss the unusually quick response by Republican senators, including Alabama's Richard Shelby, calling on Moore to step down if the allegations are true, and the staggering hypocrisy of such an aggressively holier-than-thou Christian who stands accused of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old. Then finally, we will speak with a veteran CIA analyst and author of The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at CIA, Melvin Goodman, about the possibility that Trump's head of the CIA, who has proven to be a partisan hack and an ambitious toady, could sabotage the Mueller investigation by muzzling the CIA's counterintelligence unit that he has placed under his personal control and hold back evidence that Mueller may not know exists. We will examine Mike Pompeo's record of distorting evidence of Russian interference in our election to please the beneficiary of Russian hacking, his boss, Donald Trump. And joining us now, Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation and editor of Challenge magazine. And his books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. And his latest book is Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And what do you make of the wrangling going on in the Senate now over the so-called tax reform bill? It looks like they're knocking out some of the big giveaways to the super rich, the donor class. Obviously, the trick for Paul Ryan and the House Republicans is to satisfy the donor class and to con their own voters into believing they're actually getting a middle-class tax cut. It looks like the Senate's not buying that in total. Right. So what's your sense of what's happening?
Well, one of the things that Ryan and his pals did was attack the so-called blue states, states that actually tax their citizens. California is one of them. New York is another. These are states actually that have ample, you know, that provide ample social protections and social policies for their citizens and build, pay for infrastructure and have health plans and so forth. That was a direct attack on the blue states. The Senate has, by and large, in their proposal, disallowed what these fellows are doing. They wanted to remove the deductibility of taxes paid to state and local governments, which would hurt many of us who live in these states. The Senate said no, they have... they also said no, interestingly, to ending the estate tax, which is a big deal. and they wanted to maintain the mortgage deduction. Now, I don't think it's a bad idea to drop the mortgage deduction to $500,000 from a million, mortgages of $500,000 from a million. Many of us would be hurt because house values have gone up so much. We have big mortgages, but most people don't have mortgages nearly that size, at half a million. But I think the Senate counterproposal is in the realm of good sense. Still, the big cuts and the big benefits go to the rich.
Well, from what I understand, the Senate basically 5 to 7 brackets instead of 4 with different income thresholds than the House, double the exemption on estate tax, short of full repeal. So that means it's, what, $22 million instead of 11 for a couple. Full repeal of state and local tax deductions, 1 year phase out of the 20% corporate rate. On pass-throughs, not 70-30 or 50-50, instead they have a tax deduction construct of sorts, and the child tax credit around 1600 level from the House. So the pass-through, of course, is a massive hole in revenues, right?
Yeah, I think it would be a massive hole. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips. In general, the bill, I think there's some messing up with the 25% versus 20% and so forth tax rate on these things. I think the bill wasn't well thought out, and there's a lot of business dissension about that. But I think, aside from pass-through there, you know, I guess I think the corporate tax cut to 20% is pretty outrageous, and generally the reduction of income taxes is fairly outrageous. So I think those are the dominating issues. So is ending the estate tax, and I'm glad to see the Senate. You have more details than I, but I'm glad to see the Senate doubled that. I think it's fair to tax estates,
particularly over $22 million.
Yeah,
and that's basically
there aren't too many of us who have that much money.
Right, we're talking about the 0.1% of the 1%.
Yeah,
it's the Koch brothers.
More like 0.0001%.
Right, exactly. 1% of 1% of 1%. So again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. His latest book is 7 Bad Ideas: How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World.
I'm also working on a book on child poverty in America, which is a moral scandal, but I hope we'll speak about that in the future.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, but therein lies the disconnect, doesn't it? I mean, if you cut money from food stamps in order to remove the estate tax on the super wealthy, those are the priorities. These people in the House and to a lesser extent in the Senate, these Republicans, obviously they're just so cynical, pretending this is a middle-class tax cut. The person who actually spoke truth about it, perhaps, maybe he's sorry he did, is Gary Cohn, the White House economics advisor and former chief operating officer at Goldman Sachs. In an interview on CNBC, he said the most excited group out there about this tax reform package are the big CEOs.
Right.
And he also went on to describe it as trickle-down economics. If you give the rich big corporations and the rich guys tax breaks, somehow it's going to trickle down to regular folk.
Well, I think, Ian, let me just say this. The big issue that your listeners should keep in mind is that the Republicans are claiming this is going to stimulate rapid economic growth, much more rapid than the rate under Obama, or even more rapid than the 3%. Some of them are extremely irresponsibly talking about 4 or 5% economic growth each year. It just is not going to happen. It never happened with a tax cut. Some tax cuts in our history were stimulative, like the Kennedy tax cut, and to some degree the Reagan tax cut. Both of those came with significantly higher unemployment rates than we have now, which means those economies were underperforming by a lot. And excess demand, which a tax cut can create, helps those economies along. Even if we did have an economy with a very high unemployment rate, tax cuts are not the best way to get demand. New social policies, and especially public investment in infrastructure, I think in poor children and in education, are the ways to really set this economy right again. And I don't know if Congress has it in them to do it. This president certainly doesn't have it in him.
Well, Representative Chris Collins, a Republican of New York, said, "My donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again."
Yeah,
and there's the proofs in the pudding that this is all being pushed by the Koch brothers and these other billionaires. But what I find extraordinary about that, Jeff Madrick, is we're just learning from the Paradise Papers that some of the richest Americans, including Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, have all of these offshore tax havens where they're hiding their money. And in doing so, they're making taxes more expensive for the rest of us. So
yeah, well, Mercer, too, remember,
yeah,
the big funder of Breitbart.
Right, yeah.
Is in the Paradise Papers.
Right, so here are these people getting their political agents, their hirelings, to cut their taxes. At the same time, they're hiding their money offshore so they don't have to pay tax. And all
anyway.
Of this, all of yeah, exactly. And this, all of this increases the burden on average folks. So how do you get that message across? I mean, I wish the Democrats were better at explaining. I mean, Bernie Sanders is, but
yeah,
he's just one.
Well, Democrats have some rich donors also. A lot of rich donors to the Democratic presidential campaign last time around. But it's nothing like the donors to the Republican Party, who seem often to be shameless. Maybe the Paradise Papers reporting will get that message across, but I tend to read the New York Times and the Washington Post here on the East Coast, and they are not explaining this Paradise Papers project very well because it is a tax dodge. They put that down around the 15th paragraph, I find. Now, maybe I've missed some stories. But this is basically a tax dodge. It's not to protect their money from the gnawing masses. It's to avoid paying taxes. I think that's getting out there. I hope the Tuesday elections are a suggestion that people aren't buying into the Trump idea and the Trump oligarchy the way they once did. But it's been distressing to people like you and me for a long time, Ian, because this domination of politics by the wealthy gets worse by the year. It was not always this bad. A quick story about John Kenneth Galbraith, who I had as a professor. I went to see him many years ago, several times as a journalist, and just to say hello. And I asked him, do you think the pendulum will swing back? This was maybe 15 years ago. Because Arthur Schlesinger and his father, a prominent historian, both believed that the pendulum swings in America from left to right and back from right to left. And Galbraith said, no, it wasn't at all obvious it would swing back because of the domination of money. So people have to be very well aware of that, and I think choose their voting as well in their resistance and their political campaigning for people who understand those issues, want to suppress that influence and do the right thing, which I think is ever more obvious in America because doing the right thing has been neglected for so long.
Well, there's something else that seems more sinister in this, Jeff Madrick, and you mentioned Mercer, the funder of Breitbart and of Stephen Bannon, and he's put up money they obviously forced Jeff Flake out of running for re-election for the Senate in Arizona, and they're intimidating other incumbent Republicans who are not far enough to the right in their opinion. Lindsey Graham said today that basically a failure to pass tax reform would fracture the Republican Party and lead to more far-right primary challenges. And he basically said, you know, quoting him, the financial contributions will stop. So what's clearly happening here is that these bilious billionaires are basically blackmailing the Republican senators by saying, if you don't give us our tax cuts, we will fund these crackpots, Tea Party types that Bannon is running, like Roy Moore.
Yeah. Well, I can't argue with you there, Ian, but the best place to fight that is the ballot box. I don't know why Jeff Flake dropped out. Maybe given yesterday's election, he would have had more of a chance. I do know why he dropped out, but I don't think it was for very good reasons. He should have stayed and fought. I think the only thing you can do is fight it. If we can't develop campaign laws that are actually truly effective, we have to vote against the people who are financed by extremely, extremely wealthy donors. Maybe some investigations of these people will help as well. Carl Icahn is being investigated in his relationship with Trump for getting an environmental regulation loosened. I don't say this with any joy, but there is a sexual charge against him that's just been filed. I'm not rooting for that as a path to better democracy, but it is something. People should stand up and be counted on those matters. And Ian, I don't want to sound quite as pessimistic as you are. I don't think it's inevitable that we will be taken over by the oligarchy, further taken over by the oligarchy. We already are, but I think we know about the neglect and the discrepancies and the inequalities in America. We have the highest child poverty rate in the world, which concerns me because of this book I'm writing. But that also affects all of us, because we lose a large part of the population as good workers. But those kids are in pain. Until we start understanding that, we're in trouble. Now, can I just say this as well? In some sense, while Bill Clinton did some decent things, he also began the decline of social sensitivity with his welfare reform and the failure to regulate derivatives and so forth that Larry Summers favored. And one other thing, public investment. When we had budget surpluses in the 1990s, we didn't put them back into public investment. We put them into paying down the deficit, because he had a Treasury Department that thought that was all that mattered, getting interest rates down. It led to a momentary boom and then a collapse and then a modest economic advance that led to the subprime mortgage crisis. That's another thing, Ian. I hope I'm not rambling, but George Bush's tax cuts did not lead to a charge of jobs in his 8 years. I see Republicans say that sometimes. And the TV press, of course, doesn't know everything, and sometimes they know a lot less than everything. But in George Bush's 2 terms, job creation was the slowest of any 8 years since World War II. Tax cuts didn't work in that period.
Well, just in closing, you recall Mitt Romney talking about the makers and takers in that secret video that exposed how he really thinks and how Republican donors, since he was talking to a group of them, think that 47% of the country are basically freeloaders, talking about working Americans. The truth of the matter is it's the other way around. That
exactly.
The 47% or the 50, whatever, the working Americans are the ones that are the makers. They work incredibly hard. They haven't had a raise in 40 years, for God's sake, and they work very hard and produce a lot. And the takers are the Koch brothers and Mercers. Mercer made all of his money out of hedge funding, micro, high-speed trading, just extracting wealth, not creating wealth. So this is the situation we have. But I'm not pessimistic in the sense that if we had a champion that could explain what's really going on in ways. Trump is actually pretty good at explaining stuff, albeit simplistically, to his people. He engages them in a conversation. Our politicians, most of them, talk like politicians. But if Bernie was an exception, and we found out that a huge number of Americans understand exactly what he's saying. You know, it's not news to them that they're getting hosed. So where, you know, my sense is that it's just a question of getting somebody out there to articulate what everybody knows in their bones is going on, but they don't trust the messenger so far on the left.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we have candidates, but we never know that we have capable candidates until we have them. So I agree with you. I hope somebody stands up. I think you make a really good point. The makers and takers are totally, it's exactly the opposite. And the financial community has been taking from America and creating artificial profits and diverting investment from where it's needed and putting pressure on wages. You know, I'm supporting at my foundation a high-wage America program, which I wish the Democrats would adopt. I wish they would adopt just that title, High Wage America again. And we can do that. But do we need a leader? I guess we need a leader. In my own work, though, I can't wait to depend on a leader. I just have to write the programs and the documents and the pieces I write that I think will make a better America, a decent place again. It is not really a decent place now. And people live in a myth about our glorious past. It's past. We've got to remake it.
Well, Jeff Madrick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always good to talk to you, Ian. It's been a long time. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's director of the Bernadette L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation, editor of Challenge Magazine, and his books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. And his latest book is Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing the impact of the explosive revelations in a Washington Post investigation of Judge Roy Moore, who's running for the Senate in Alabama, who is a devout Christian but stands accused of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Zach McCrary, who's a partner at ALG Research based in Montgomery, Alabama, who has served as a pollster and strategist for members of Congress, mayors, state legislative caucuses, and public interest groups. Previously, he served as a communications director for the Alabama Democratic Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zach McCrary.
Thanks so much.
And this investigative piece just released by the Washington Post, woman says Roy Moore initiated sexual encounter when she was 14. He was 32. It seems to have exploded as a story. And I've never seen the U.S. Senate respond so quickly. And John McCain calls the report disqualifying, saying that Moore should immediately quit the race. And other Republican senators have said if the allegations are true, he should step down. And that includes Jeff Flake of Arizona, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, not entirely surprising there, but David Perdue of Georgia, and the senior senator in Moore's home state, where you are in Alabama, Richard Shelby, also says that. So what do you make of that?
This is a very big deal. This is a very big deal. It's often difficult to assess, you know, the scope of an issue like this in the moment, but I do believe this is a very big deal. When you look at scandal-plagued Republicans who have lost in Republican red states in the recent past, Todd Akin in Missouri, or Richard Murdoch in Indiana, both who lost U.S. Senate seats in 2012 at the same time that their states were being carried by Mitt Romney, both of those Republican nominees had made very deeply offensive comments about abortion, abortion and rape comments. You know, that's, you know, rhetoric, extreme offensive rhetoric compared to what Moore is charged with here. The report of Moore committing sexual abuse of a 14-year-old, certainly a night and day difference. But it took Republicans days, weeks to distance themselves fully from a Todd Akin, from a Richard Murdoch. We see that within minutes, Republicans started distancing themselves from Roy Moore, which I think speaks to how dramatic this disclosure is and how disqualifying it is, not just for politicians, but how disqualifying I believe it will be for Alabama voters.
Well, you know, I've often thought that Stephen Bannon has been way out of his depths and has been given so much publicity as some kind of, you know, strategic guru and genius. And my sense is if you pick people like Roy Moore as your political vanguard for the future, or Chemtrails Kelly, as she's called, the woman he's running against in Jeff Flake's seat, you know, effectively they forced Jeff Flake out. It just seems to me that extraordinary that this is the quality of people that are going to bring about the new American Revolution and get rid of the administrative state. Do you think this is also going to be a black eye for Bannon?
You know, it should be. It absolutely should be. I would say in Bannon has been a, you know, his strategic skills, I think, are questionable, but his PR skills, I think, are admirable. And in Alabama, Bannon just got in front of the Roy Moore parade at the last minute. You know, Bannon has tried to take credit for Roy Moore when Roy Moore, you know, had a head of steam, and Roy Moore would have won without Bannon doing anything for Roy Moore in the state. And so in that respect, Bannon, I think, is taking credit, took credit for that he did not deserve for the emergence, the reemergence of Roy Moore in Alabama. But it feels like that is going to bite Bannon for the very reasons you articulate, with Roy Moore being you know, a deep embarrassment, not just to the state of Alabama, which I believe he is, but, you know, discrediting any political movement in which that embraces Roy Moore, which includes the Bannon version of the Republican Party.
And again, I'm speaking with Zach McCrary, who's a partner at ALG Research based in Montgomery, Alabama. He served as a pollster and strategist for members of Congress, mayors, state legislative caucuses, and public interest groups, and previously served as the communications director for the Alabama Democratic Party. Now, of course, Roy Moore, in a written statement to the Washington Post, denied the story and said these allegations are completely false and are a desperate political attack by the National Democratic Party and the Washington Post on his campaign. You're there down in Alabama. Does this have anything to do with Doug Jones, the Democrat who's running against him? Is there any? I can't imagine. As far as I can tell, the Washington Post sent reporters down there. They've done a very thorough job. There's an awful lot of detail in this investigative report. There are four women involved, all of whom claim that Roy Moore made inappropriate advances to them when they were very young and he was in his 30s. The youngest, of course, that we're talking about here, who's where he's really in trouble, is Lee Kaufman. She was 14 when he tried to seduce her and gave her alcohol and took her clothes off. 14, and now the age of consent in Alabama is 16. I believe the other three were 16 when he dated them, but still, a guy in his 30s dating a 16-year-old, that doesn't sound right.
No, listen, I think people can see through this. We've been through this. We've seen this before, you know, in the last several weeks with several high-profile sexual predators, you know, being exposed. Alabama voters have been through this in the last couple of years, where we had a scandal-plagued governor brought down who resigned office due to a sex scandal within the last year, who initially blamed his political enemies for these rumors, who denied all of these allegations until the facts became so apparent that he fled from office in disgrace. So Alabama voters are not suckers. Roy Moore, might think Alabama voters are suckers. Alabama voters are not dupes. Alabama voters can see through this. The facts are the facts. This is a very well-researched piece. The victim, the then 14-year-old victim, is now a Republican who voted for Donald Trump. These are not political attacks. This is the weight of years of misdeeds, of crimes, perhaps in some instances of crimes coming back to bite Roy Moore, and he's going to have to live with the consequences.
So the MO for Roy Moore was, and this is when he was an assistant district attorney, in his early 30s, was to wander around the Gadsden Mall and pick up these young women. I think three of them actually worked there in the mall in different shops. But the most incriminating one of all being the 14-year-old Lee Kaufman, who, as you mentioned, is a Republican and voted for Trump. He arranged for her to be picked up by him in his car around the block so that her mother wouldn't see her. I mean, and then he took her to his house in the woods and took her clothes off, gave her alcohol, and lay on top of her. Well, I don't need to go into any further details, but the MO seems to be that of a sexual predator hanging out at the Gadsden Mall.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there seems to be a pattern, right? I mean, a pattern that the report verified with independent sources. I think from what I read, the multiple people who have made these, multiple women who have told their stories or independent of each other, tell a very similar story. Even under the most favorable light, Roy Moore has always been a very unusual person. Roy Moore disappeared from the state in the 80s, I believe, 80s, early 90s, to go to Australia to work as a cowboy. So, he's a very unusual person. I think perhaps this fills in some blanks as to what his MO is, as to why, fleshes out some of the things that have always seemed to make Moore such an unusual person, an unorthodox politician, obviously in a much more sinister way than we have known up till now.
Well, but the whole point of this, surely, Zach McCrary, is that we wouldn't be talking about this if this man wasn't such a devout Christian and didn't wear his religion on his sleeve and wasn't an aggressive Christian proselytizer who put up the Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse and fought the all the way to the Supreme Court and even defied the Supreme Court. This wouldn't be a story or wouldn't be an issue. I mean, nobody wants to go after somebody on the basis of their religion. But when you wear your religion on the sleeve, and then it turns out, in terms of these allegations, you try to seduce a 14-year-old girl, which is certainly a violation of one of the Ten Commandments, I think he's fair game, isn't he?
No, I mean, I'm not sure. I think I disagree on the fact that I think any person who has committed some of the, again, we're talking about actual crimes. Sexual
sure.
abuse is the crime. At stake. I think it's fair game for anyone who is in those similar shoes. I do think it certainly cuts to the quick more when it comes to Roy Moore. It's so contrary to his core brand, but at the same time he's always been, I don't know exactly how this plays out politically, but Roy Moore has always been a politician that repeatedly embarrassed the state of Alabama, and here he is again embarrassing the state of Alabama at a time when the state is at the epicenter of the nation's political discussion. Here we go again with Roy Moore.
Well, the distinction I would make, Zach, and obviously this is a crime if it's proven, a 14-year-old girl, and the age of consent being 16 is pretty low to begin with, in Alabama, but that is a crime, unquestionably. The point I was trying to make is look at the difference between Roy Moore and Donald Trump. Donald Trump effectively got away with bragging on camera that he could grab women by their genitals and get away with it. I think he got away with it because, you know, he didn't set such a high moral bar. He never pretended to be saintly, whereas Roy Moore pretends to be saintly, does he not?
No, certainly that you know, he has put himself above the law. He says he answers to God, not to the U.S. Supreme Court, not even to the Alabama voters. So he certainly has created an image unto himself as a hyper, you know, religious figure, you know, almost a cult-like figure among those who support him, and it certainly does, make the hypocrisy angle even more alarming. And again, we've seen this, unfortunately, we've been through this before, seeing this pattern of abuse by, you know, religious figures, over the last several years, and so it does feel like a pattern we've seen before, and certainly, you know, it is not the first time we've seen the most religious evangelical conservative type figures among us. Many times have skeletons in their closet. Here, this time, you know, not just personal foibles, but, you know, breaking the law, allegedly committing sexual abuse against a 14-year-old.
Well, Zach McCrary, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thanks for your time.
And again, I've been speaking with Zach McCrary, who's a partner at ALG Research based in Montgomery, Alabama, who has served as a pollster and strategist for members of Congress, mayors, state legislative caucuses, and public interest groups. And previously, he served as the communications director for the Alabama Democratic Party. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a veteran CIA analyst about the possibility that Trump's head of the CIA could sabotage the Mueller investigation.
Oh, Alabama, the devil fools with the best laid plan. Swing low, Alabama, you got the spare chain, you got to feel strange. And now, but they beg you, wait my name. I got one hell of a job, performed for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day, I salute the flag and say, thank you, Jesus, because I'm a secret agent, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. Goodman is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and his latest book is The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at CIA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Mel. And what do you make of the story that apparently is roiling professional intelligence officers, and particularly those at the CIA, that the director of the Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, at the urging of President Trump, met with William Binney, a former NSA official who has a conspiracy theory that the DNC hack was not done by the Russians, but done by a U.S. intelligence insider?
Well, I think the problem here is that Trump had attacked the CIA even before he was inaugurated. His visit to the CIA the day after he was inaugurated was a disaster. His appointment of Pompeo as a CIA director was quite objectionable, and Pompeo turned around and appointed a supporter of torture and abuse, Gina Haspel, to be his deputy. And I think Pompeo signaled from the very first that he was going to be meddlesome in terms of intelligence, particularly on anything to do with the Iranian nuclear accord, where the CIA played a major role and received a secret letter from Secretary of State John Kerry thanking them for the good work they did. So already, I think the CIA and its personnel have been sort of on alert in anticipating that there were going to be problems with this director. Now Pompeo has met, at the urging of President Trump, as you say, with Bill Binney. I know Bill Binney. He's an outstanding national security agency crypto analyst. He led some very important divisions there, but he's come up with this bizarre conspiratorial theory. Actually, his first theory was that the hacking was an inside job, that there was a person inside the DNC who downloaded these documents on a flash drive and then somehow got them to Assange. The DNC person who Binney was referring to, even though he was not mentioned by name, was an individual having to be killed on Capitol Hill months after these accusations. And, of course, that fed even more conspiracy theories. Now, Binney's attracted to this notion, as some of his fellow organizers at the BIPs group, these are the retired intelligence officers who come up with one conspiracy theory after another, that now this is part of the deep state, which is really bizarre. But Trump will hang his hat on any theory that suggests that Russians had nothing to do with this, that his election was legitimate, and Hillary Clinton is a fraud. So Binney's theory, and I imagine Breitbart had something to do with getting this information to him, set up Pompeo, sort of forced him to meet with Binney to at least hear him out. But in the wake of the meeting, there was a CIA spokesperson who suggested that Pompeo wasn't changing any of his support for the original intelligence community memo that came in on January the 6th, mainly the FBI, the NSA, and the CIA, that this was indeed Russian hacking. Pompeo was in trouble over that report because he said it showed that the Russian hacking had nothing to do with the election, whereas that was never part of the key issues to be settled in the memo in the first place. So Pompeo, I find, is reckless. He's an ideologue. He's a Tea Party congressman from Kansas, very hostile to Hillary Clinton, very engaged in the Benghazi affair to try to pin this on Hillary Clinton, very hostile to the Iranian comprehensive plan of action. He's the worst possible kind of person you can have as a director of a central intelligence agency. And frankly, if you look at the two former directors are now Pompeo, who came from the Hill. I'm talking about Porter Goss, of course, a former congressman, George Tenet, a former staffer on the Intelligence Committee, and now Pompeo. They were all involved in politicizing intelligence. So the Congress is really not the place to go to for finding objective analysts who are willing to tell truth to power. And Pompeo may turn out to be the biggest disaster of them all.
Well, but what is worrying about Pompeo is that one of the first things he did was he put the CIA's counterintelligence unit that are looking into the Russian involvement in the U.S. election, having them report directly to him. So if he's as partisan as he appears to be, he could quash Mueller's efforts to get CIA information to help in his inquiry, could he not?
Well, he certainly could be in a position to do that. On this one is that the CIA has already shared its information mainly with Senator Mark Warner, the minority leader of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I assume with Mueller's people. Now there will be further collection, and you have to wonder what role Pompeo will play, because he's clearly going to be a filter. He will do for President Trump, I'm afraid, what Robert Gates did for William Casey in sort of filtering the analysis and filtering the collection to get the information that the president wants. So this is a very dangerous situation. I think Mueller is on thin ice anyway. I don't know how much longer Trump can afford to put up with Mueller. And given his narcissism and his propensity for narcissistic rages, who knows when that morning will come when he'll wake up and say Mueller's got to go, despite what his lawyers are telling him not to make such a move, given what happened to Nixon over the firing of Cox in the Watergate affair. So these are very troubled waters that we're in. I thought we would get a respite with him out of the country, particularly in China, where he would have some limitations on his use of his Twitter account. But it seems day to day, we just go from one chaotic situation to another. And as Jeb Bush said during one of the debates, he's a chaotic candidate, and he'll be a chaotic president. Well, Jeb Bush had it right.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. Goodman is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and his latest book is The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at CIA. So let's talk then about what the CIA has. We know they must have a big file on Paul Manafort. Otherwise, they would be completely derelict because he was working for a foreign power, the Ukrainian government, but really Yanukovych. If you work for Yanukovych, you're actually working for Putin. And we know there's a massive money trail going from Putin through Gazprom into Yanukovych and into his predecessors as well. And we know that Manafort stuck with Yanukovych to the very end, even while his Praetorian Guard was shooting Ukrainian protesters. They killed 140 or so. But then we know also that Manafort took $60 million in loans from Russian oligarchs close to Putin. Manafort's right-hand man inside of Ukraine, where he spent many, many years working with Yanukovych, is and was a former GRU colonel in Russian military intelligence. I mean, need I go on?
Well, one thing needs to be said, however, that the CIA could be on very shaky ground if they're having this voluminous collection on an American citizen. They better have a good reason for it. My guess is it's the National Security Agency that conducts comprehensive intercepts of Russian individuals, Russian officials, and I'm sure Manafort's name is all over the place in these collections. So regardless of whether it's the NSA or the CIA, I think the material on Manafort and the case that can be made is pretty solid. What Mueller has done in terms of his indictments, and I think it was a doozy of a day when he indicted Manafort, and then we found out about Papandreou, these are cases that are solid. You know, you don't need witnesses. You don't need a lot of testimony. It's all down there on paper. So the paper trail and the corruption trail is rather strong. And when you think, it's kind of interesting that in the past year or so, we've seen major heads of state like Xi Jinping in China and Vladimir Putin in Russia conduct these major campaigns against corruption. And now you have a Prince Salman in Saudi Arabia conducting his own campaign against corruption. When is the United States going to get serious about a campaign against corruption? Because the Republican chairman of both the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee, they're still acting like they're defense attorneys for President Trump and not doing the kind of investigation that's needed. So I hope the minority members, whether it's Dianne Feinstein or Mark Warner, are putting together a file for the day when, and it might be 2018, when the Democrats take back the House and or the Senate and can start to subpoena individuals and get serious about these investigations. If these committees are supposed to be the guardrails of democracy, then the guardrails are down, and we're going to have a problem. So right now, all we have going for us in terms of reviving our democracy is a very intense investigation by Mueller, which is continuing, and the question is how long will Trump let it continue, or will there be some narcissistic rage that sort of changes the activity that we're seeing?
Well, the corruption investigations you mentioned by Xi Jinping and Putin and now by MBS, the boy king in Saudi Arabia, all of them are designed, of course, to go after the political enemies of Putin, Xi, and MBS. Hopefully, if we to have a corruption inquiry here in the United States, it would not be targeted at the political enemies of those conducting the investigation. But back on Manafort, I'm surprised that the CIA would be constrained from intelligence collecting on Manafort's activity inside of Ukraine. I know he's an American citizen, but
the CIA cannot target an American citizen in a situation
right.
like that.
Right.
They can target others, but if they find illegal activity about Americans, that's information that has to be turned over to the Justice Department. So I think in that case, what they find has already been turned over to the Justice Department, and Mueller has seen it. Mm-hmm. Now, any continuing investigation and continuing collection could run into the problem of a Pompeo who's going to act as a defense attorney for his president. And it'll be interesting to see how far Pompeo will go in trying to defend this man. I think it's interesting that he met with Binney. I mean, he was told to meet with Binney, and so he did it. But then a CIA spokesman made it clear that Pompeo still stands by the January 6, 2017 statement of CIA and FBI and NSA that this was Russian hacking. And actually, the evidence of the Russian hacking is so overwhelming that Binney's colleagues, also former members of NSA, have issued a counter memo. They don't agree with Binney. And I sometimes wonder why Binney has gone as far as he had with this conspiracy theory to include a notion of the deep state. I mean, this is a ridiculous left-wing conspiracy theory showing that the left can be just as stupid as the right on these matters. And I find that worrisome.
Well, Binney and a lot of those people in BIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, are regulars on RT, and that in itself is pretty questionable, I would think, given...
Well, I think they're desperate for any kind of exposure whatsoever. So if you look at what this group has done, the VIPS group, I mean, they've compromised a lot of the evidence on the shootdown of the Malaysian aircraft over Ukraine. They've challenged a lot of the good information on Syrian use of chemical weapons. They're big supporters of the notion of a deep state. I find they're almost nihilistic in their regard to how to treat the American political process. And they're causing a tremendous cynicism about the American political process. You know, there are things that are working successfully. I think the Mueller effort is working.
That's the whole purpose of RT and Putin, is to get Americans to, both on the left and the right, to get cynical about their government.
They've been very successful. This has always been a goal of Soviet and now Russian disinformation and what they call active measures. CIA plays the same game against Russia, which I think gets in the way of doing what we did with China. When China went into the computers of OPM, Office of Personnel and Management, and found so many names of government officials, including CIA people, undercover, we met privately with Beijing and created rules of the road. And this clearly has to happen with Russia as well. But it's very difficult to have any dealings with Russia. You've got Trump surrounded by military officers who are very hostile to Russia. You have a Secretary of State who's in over his head, has no understanding of any of these issues, and has really done what Steve Bannon wanted in terms of deconstruction of the administrative state by really decimating the Department of State. There are 24 top positions at State in terms of assistant secretaries, deputy secretaries, and undersecretaries. He's filled two of the 24 slots. People are not receiving promotions, and in the up-or-out system of the State Department, it means you're forced to retire. So we don't really have an active State Department. We don't have any active civilian management of the national security process. So I'm not encouraged when people say, and some very important pundits have said this, that at least there's some adults in the room. And then they cite General Kelly and General McMaster and General Mattis. I don't consider them responsible adults in the room. I taught at the National War College for 18 years, and I'm not overly critical of the military, but I would say that it's a culture that's a subordinate culture that doesn't produce a lot of independent thinking and certainly has no knowledge on the serious geopolitical issues that we face. They're hostile to Russia. They're hostile to arms control and disarmament. They don't understand some of the relations that we have with our alliance partners. So there's no one providing any really long-term wisdom on these strategic matters, and that I find a major worry that needs to be addressed.
But when you bring up Tillerson, who's obviously on shaky ground, and Nikki Haley clearly wants his job, but a lot of observers in Washington think that Mike Pompeo has the inside track on being the next Secretary of State. And my sense would be that his ambitions would override his duty to be impartial and to do the right thing, in terms of the evidence that Mueller either has or wants.
Well, there's no question that both Haley and Pompeo are ambitious. To me, there's no question that they're in over their heads on all of these issues. So you've got to be careful what you wish for. But I know a lot of people at the Department of State. I know people, I've talked to people who've briefed Tillerson. And for the first few months in briefing Tillerson, they would come back after a briefing and say, you know, he just doesn't get it. But more recently, now they've come back from a briefing of Tillerson and they say, he'll never get it. So, again, there's no civilian contribution to the national security decision-making or national security process. And this is not what the Founding Fathers wanted in terms of how the government was constructed. You know, the Secretary of State, in terms of cabinet members, is first in line of succession. The State Department has always been an elite institution. It's always provided a certain amount of strategic background for the conceptualization of American policy. They're not in that position anymore. And to have a national security advisor who's not only a general but an active duty general running the National Security Council, which is an extremely weak organization at this time, and to have a president out in traveling around Asia with his limited knowledge of Asian politics while there is no Assistant Secretary of State for Asian affairs. So this country right now is so undermanned and understaffed that you have to worry about what's going to happen to the American position in the international community, where there's no trust in terms of the Secretary of State. He obviously doesn't speak for the president. The president has said very angry things about his Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State has attacked the President of the United States. So it's an incredibly bizarre situation, and I think it's likely that Tillerson will be home for Christmas, and you'll have a Haley or a Pompeo in that position. And that, I think, would be just going from bad to worse.
Well, just in closing, just as recently as October the 19th, Mike Pompeo, in response to a question from NBC News' Vivian Salama, who asked, can you say without absolute certainty that the election results were not skewed as a result of Russian interference? Pompeo replied, yes. The intelligence community's assessment is that the Russian meddling that took place did not affect the outcome of the election. Well, that is absolutely patently false. I mean, I can't...
Well, he had to be corrected by his own agency. A press spokesman made it clear that Pompeo stands by the language of the January 6th statement, and they were never charged with assessing the impact on the election.
Sure.
They were merely charged with what kind of activity did Russia conduct. And here the evidence is very strong that this is the kind of hacking that went on. So it's hard to see what Bill Binney's game is, because, again, I know Bill. He lectures to my classes at Johns Hopkins. He's an outstanding crypto analyst. He knows this field. So you have to wonder what in the world is driving him right now.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Mel Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. Goodman is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his latest book is The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at CIA. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.